Good afternoon. Call to order the House Committee on Rules for Wednesday, March 20, 2013.
We could do that.
We have two very exciting bills up today. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2198. Ms. Seiler, what is this bill?
Members, House Bill 2198 requires designated voter registration agencies to submit change of address information to Secretary of State for purposes of updating voter registration. If Secretary of State receives change of address information from National Voter Registration Agency that is different from current information, Secretary shall provide information to County Clerk of affected county. I believe there is an amendment that will be discussed by the Secretary when she comes forward.
All right. Secretary of State Kay Brown, Mr. Trout. Welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Kate Brown, serving as your Secretary of State. To my right is my Elections Director, Steve Trout, and I appreciate the opportunity to be before you today on the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2198. Since Oregonians enacted vote by mail in 1998, turnout amongst registered voters has consistently ranked amongst the highest in the country. We make it convenient and easy for registered voters to cast a ballot because you don't have to wait in line. Waiting in line is an unnecessary barrier to exercising the right to vote. Vote by mail is a secure system because we confirm the validity of every single signature on every single ballot. Oregon's record of voter participation of all eligible voters, however, is decidedly less impressive. One quarter of all eligible Oregonians could not cast a ballot on Election Day 2012 because of registration requirements. A dozen states of all political stripes, from Idaho to Iowa to Maine, have removed the barrier of unnecessary paperwork while maintaining ballot security. These states allow voters to register at the polls on Election Day with proof of eligibility. One same-day registration state, and also happens to be my home state where I grew up, Minnesota, has led the nation in eligible voter turnout for most of the last decade. With House Bill 2198, the Dash 1 amendments, we seek to mimic that success, but do it in Oregon style. We propose to build on the success and popularity of vote by mail and use well-tested technology to remove an unnecessary barrier to voting while maintaining ballot security. The National Voter Registration Act designates the Department of Motor Vehicles as a voter registration agency and allows the Secretary of State to designate other state agencies as voter registration agencies. For example, Department of Human Services is an example of a designated NVRA agency. NVRA requires voter registration agencies to provide all eligible voters with the opportunity to register or update their voter registration information anytime they interact with that particular voter. The agency must then provide that information to elections offices so voters can be added to the rolls or so their voter information can be updated as appropriate. Our amendment to House Bill 2198 would only apply to NVRA agencies that do four things. Maintain a digital copy of a person's signature, have the capacity to process citizenship data, and collect age and residence information. As of today, only the Department of Motor Vehicles meets that standard. The amendment requires covered agencies to provide the information submitted by all eligible voters to the Secretary of State so that the Secretary of State can register qualified electors to vote. Once qualified electors have been registered to vote, they will receive a postcard in the mail letting them know that they can choose a party designation and how they can do that. Or they can choose to opt out, sign the postcard, and return it, postage paid. This is exactly the same secure information and processes we use with our online voter registration system. People tend to focus on elections in the final weeks of the campaign. Our amendment will take a major step toward ensuring that every eligible Oregon voter who wants to cast a ballot on Election Day can do so. Our amendment achieves the same goals as same-day voter registration, but does so in a way that builds on our vote-by-mail system. Our amendment is secure because the Elections Division will import the digital copy of the signature maintained by the Department of Motor Vehicles, just like we do on our online voter registration system, enabling election day comparison of signatures on every single ballot. We estimate that the amendment will result in the registration of about 500,000 new voters by January 1st, 2014, and that about 93% of eligible Oregonians would be registered to vote. Our goal, quite simply, is to build on the vision of vote by mail, and that is to deliver a ballot into the hands of every eligible Oregon voter. Thank you so much, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. I greatly apologize for being late, Madam Secretary. Will the new registrants be subject to the public disclosure laws in a comparable way that current registrants are? Will the Secretary of State have to turn over election registration information for the registrants proposed in this bill in a way that they're currently doing so?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, yes.
Thanks.
Representative Berger.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Secretary. What about, doesn't voter registration automatically enroll you in the jury pool, possibility of being called for a juror, whether you wanted to or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, my understanding is that the jury pools, and I know that Chief Justice DeMunis in the room, my understanding is that they were using DMV roles for jury pools.
Further question? What about people who, the DMV has a whole number of provisions. It seems to me, Madam Secretary, let me preamble this, that you are exposing people who have not been asked for. I mean, people can ask to be registered, and it's very simple and very easy, and we've made it extremely easy. But you're basically preempting the ask and saying, before you even ask, we are going to do this for you. And this bothers me on a number of levels, because not everyone asks, not everyone wants, and there are protections, for instance, in DMV laws for people who are being stalked, for people who have a number of reasons for not wanting data, and I presume you've accounted for that in here, but a lot of people, for various reasons, do not, and they aren't bad reasons, they're personal reasons, do not want their data shared between agencies, and this just seems like an automatic opt-in when people have plenty of opportunities to opt-in if they care to, and this would put you on the opt-out list, and I really have heartburn over it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, you have a number of concerns. I'll address a couple of them. First of all, one of the reasons we brought this amendment forward is that we hear continuously as we are completing election cycles about people who fall through the cracks, who've been to a NVRA agency, who know they signed out the paperwork, and they ended up not appearing on the voter registration rolls. So there's the concern right now that you have Oregonians who attempted to register, filled out the paperwork, and are not on the voter registration roll. Secondly, the intent of the amendment is to provide a very robust opt-out provision, essentially a signature that would say the voter does not choose to be on the voter registration roll, and to provide a postage paid opportunity to make that happen. The last, I just want to mention the security that's available. We currently have victims of domestic violence who are registered to vote, and there are security provisions in the system for them, and those would continue for those who wish to have it moving forward.
Representative Dembrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Madam Secretary. As we look at how this program would be rolled out, you know, I could see that there would be some expenses involved in just processing those cancellations and the opt-outs and, you know, just doing the work. But I can also see potential for savings. Have you done a fiscal analysis of it yet, of just how much might be it would cost or might be saved?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dembro, we estimate the fiscal to be somewhere beneath $500,000. We can use federal Help America Vote Act dollars to develop the system. In terms of our current voter registration process, the only study I have is one dated from 2008 that Pew did. I can provide that to the committee. That's more a comparison of paper registration versus online registration and the savings there, but that can give you a sense of the cost. And I believe there are a couple of county clerks in the room. They can speak to that.
Thank you.
Just on Representative Berger's point about people who are going to be become part of the system and don't want to be there, and the amendment provides for them to be given an option to opt out. How long would that take? I mean, how long would it take to get them the notice that this has happened and you can choose to opt out if you wish?
Great question, Mr. Chair. And Representative Berger, I just want to add, one of the legislators, Representative Thatcher, raised the issues of privacy, and I did put in a call to the Attorney General today. I think there is an issue regarding public data and our privacy, and it's something that is most pertinent within the Attorney General's jurisdiction, but it is also something we should be involved with as well, and that's something I'm interested in exploring as Representative Thatcher works out her what I think is described as an amendment to the bill. So,
could I pursue just one more thing,
sure.
Mr. Chair? Madam Secretary, you and I have had this conversation, and I want to make it real clear on the record that I have had an ongoing objection to the fact that because state agencies can share data doesn't mean they should. And in the voter's mind, just because DMV can send you this data doesn't mean that when you interface with DMV, you automatically say, oh, and I want this information shared. I have this objection not only in terms of this, but in terms of all kinds of data sharing with the technology we have, the opportunity to share data within the government is appalling to me. And I am philosophically believe that as citizens, we go to an agency for a service provided by that agency, and it does not automatically authorize a full plate of interagency automatic connections. And this is fundamental to me, and that is my primary objection here. There's all kinds of security concerns, but because I walk into DMV doesn't mean, it means I want to do something at DMV. It doesn't mean I want to register to vote. And this would be an automatic thing that really sticks at me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, you and I have had that conversation, and I appreciate your concerns. I think one of the things that I would say about this particular bill and this particular issue is that the data sharing is already happening with DMV at this point in time in terms of the digital signature. That's the information that we use to do online voter registration for Oregonians. We've had at this point over 300,000 Oregonians use the online voter registration system. The only way we can make that happen, frankly, is through the DMV. Only Oregonians who have a driver's license, a permit, or an ID card can use the online system.
One more. We have had this discussion. But of course, the DMV asks, would you like to register to vote? And if the answer is in the affirmative, it is transferred. In this case, it would be transferred, and then they're asked, would you like to vote? And that's the fundamental objection that I have. Thank you.
Yeah.
We can talk about it again.
And Mr. Chair, in response to your question about timing, it depends upon the system and what we work out. But obviously, we'd like to do it in a relatively short period of time.
Representative Kenemer.
Thank you. I haven't had the chance to see your amendment yet in writing and spend some time with it. But following up on this, I thought that you said in your comment that if someone did not wish to be registered, they would need to sign a declining note. So I guess following up on in Representative Berger's comment, so actually you're going to register them and they have the option of deregistering, if I understand your process.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kenemer, that is correct. And we chose to go that route for a couple of reasons. One, we wanted to have a signature that we could compare to confirm that it is the particular voter who wishes to opt out, so that we can compare that signature. That's one measure of security. And secondly, it's good for the NVRA to have the list of declinations available.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm going to have to think some about that. I think fundamentally it's always been my understanding that we have the right to vote and the privilege of voting. And I've always understood those as separate functions. I also think that endemic to humanity is the notion that something that you activate is more powerful and reinforcing than something that is given to you. And I think this is a fundamental change in our notion about a person's responsibility for voting. So I have some concerns about that. A second one is, and I don't need you to necessarily, you can respond to that or not. I guess my second one is, and I'm just in the beginning phases of trying to understand that and get some. Are you familiar with some of the complaints from some of the small parties who have concerns about the enormous impact this potentially has for them, because it raises the threshold for their being recognized for putting people on the ballot and being registered as either a minor or a majority party? And I think when you're going to add, that 500,000, I think we have 2.1 million voters now, so you're going to add 25% more. That's an enormous hurdle. And I don't know, I guess I'd like to hear you address the fairness of that to the minority parties in the short term.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kennemer, I've always been a strong supporter of minor parties, and we are willing to work with them on the details. This bill is to enfranchise thousands of Oregonians and isn't intended to impact the work of any particular political party. The reason why I support the minor parties is because I think it's a way of enfranchising Oregonians in all levels of the political spectrum. In terms of your comment about people needing to take a step towards voting, there should be no barrier or hurdle to exercise your right to vote. And North Dakota is the state that I can share with you that has absolutely no voter registration system. They're a relatively small state. Yep. But they do not have a registration system whatever. Because it's Oregon and because it's vote by mail, I think it's imperative that we have a voter registration system. And so this is the route that we chose to go.
Any further questions or comments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Halvey.
I just wanted to clarify, I'm sure I heard this right, but when somebody registers to vote in this system, they're not picking a party necessarily, or do they?
Mr. Chair, Representative Halvey, no. They would be automatically registered as non-affiliated voters, and we would provide them the information that they need to register with a particular party should they choose to do that.
Thanks.
All right. Madam Secretary, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Trout, thank you. Tim Scott and Steve Druckenmiller, please.
And members, as the gentleman come forward, I just want you to note that we have received testimony on this bill, and it is on OLIS from Annette Ashenbrenner, Ruth Bendel, Violet and Lynn Burton, Connie Dunham, Janice Deisinger, Cappy Eaton, Jim Hubbard, Dan Meek, Kurt White, and a nice lady named Sherry from Bend.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, my name is Tim Scott. I'm the Director of Elections for Multnomah County. Today here, testifying on behalf of Multnomah County. Multnomah County supports the Secretary's proposed amendments to House Bill 2198. As she said, Oregon is well known for its innovative vote-by-mail system, and I think this is the next step in innovation with voter registration. Additionally, I think it's good for voters. The Constitution currently provides for a 21-day deadline for voter registration. Because that deadline is in the Constitution, it provides very few options for either voters or election administrators to get people registered to vote after that point. And every election, I speak with a number of voters who have gone to DMV and are absolutely positive that they did everything they needed to do in order to register to vote, yet we have no record of their voter registration card being delivered to us. I think that this automation of this process ensures that those people will not be disenfranchised in the future. I also think this is good for election administration. In a county as large as Multnomah County, automation is where we find our efficiencies. The fact that this amendment to this bill will allow for electronic transfer of records from the DMV to the Secretary of State and then to county elections offices provides for that efficiency. When paper forms are received in the office, they first must need to be cut down to a standard size, scanned into the voter registration system. The data has to be checked against the database to ensure that it's not a duplicate registration, and if it is, match it up to the registered voter. And those forms also have to be batched and archived. And in Multnomah County, that's a permanent record, therefore they're archived forever. The electronic file essentially is all we need to get that voter registered and get them a ballot. And an electronic registration currently takes about one-tenth the time to process than a paper registration card. So there would be some savings and efficiency in moving to an electronic transfer of records from the DMV. And currently DMV provides up to 59% of all paper registrations that we receive in Multnomah County. That varies by year, of course. In the presidential election cycles, third-party registration groups supply a majority of the paper registration cards that we receive, but certainly in the off years, DMV is the number one source of registration. And to the question of cost that I believe Mr. Denbrough, or Representative Denbrough, brought up, there will be upfront and ongoing costs to this bill. Certainly, you can't add 500,000 registered voters to the rolls without some sort of impact financially. However, I'd like to point out that with every presidential election comes a voter registration surge. In Multnomah County alone, we registered 50,000 additional voters between the primary and the general election. Providing accurate election and registration services for the citizens of Multnomah County is what we do. Whether those registrations come from third-party registration groups or from the proposal that's in front of you now. And I'd like to urge your support for this amendment to this bill. I think it's good for voters and it's good for election administration. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Steve Druckenmiller. I'm the county clerk in Linn County. My county's a little bit different size than Tim's. Our processes are a little bit different. And I, for the record, agree with Tim Scott that this is good for the voters. It's good for election administration. And even beyond that, it's good for our culture and our society. Because voting is what we have risked everything on. I've been county clerk for 27 years in Linn County. My mentor and my dear friend, my predecessor, Del Riley, is the county clerk who brought vote by mail to Oregon. I can say that some of the concerns that I've heard expressed here already today kind of mirror the concerns with vote by mail when Mr. Riley first proposed it. What do you mean you're giving a ballot to somebody who didn't go to the polling place and ask for it? What about the cost? And this isn't how we've done things before. On on March 12th, I completed conducting my 144th election, and of those elections, it was the 116th vote by mail. And I can look at you from my heart as an Oregonian, an election administrator, an American, and tell you that vote by mail has changed the face of elections. Now, when Mr. Riley left office, he told me, kid, because I was a kid back then, believe it or not, that you're going to need to work to expand this. He had already reported to the legislature that eventually this will be the system used by Oregon for every election. But along with that, you're going to have to find how to reach more people. Now, some think this is the natural evolution that we would do with vote by mail. No, it's actually been the missing component of vote by mail, is how do you get these large numbers of people who are not part of the system to become part of that system. And we heard from Secretary of State Brown about the vision of vote by mail, which is exactly a quote from Del Riley, that he wanted to put a ballot in the hand of every eligible voter. Well, part of the barrier to doing that is our registration laws, which we need to have. This component now of enfranchising people is exactly right, and in my opinion, to what I heard. This is a different concept from what we've been doing before. And to me, it is a bold concept, and it is a natural concept that I endorse, and I hope you will too. There are, Tim has already related about people who have come to him, and so has Secretary, about who are lost in the cracks, and that doesn't need to be. There's some things that we will just never agree on, and I think we need to find a way of just realizing that and moving on. But please consider this bill. Consider the thousands and thousands of Oregonians who could be brought into our system who will make it stronger, which is what we all want. I'm elected, you're elected. Let's trust the voters and try to bring them into our system and make it stronger, just as vote by mail did. And I thank you.
Thank you both. Questions? Representative Dembrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Can you speak to the challenges of doing address changes? I mean, somebody, you may get somebody's address based on their driver's license, and they may, especially young people, I'm thinking of college student age people who are moving around a lot. How will you stay on top of that?
Representative Dembrough, a lot of the details of this bill have yet to be worked out, or this process, but we currently use things like the NCOA, which is the National Change of Address. Currently, Multnomah County is comparing our list once a month to the NCOA list and updating based on that. We're only required to do it once a year by statute, but we find that at least the last 2 months that we've been doing it, we get about 7,000 records, 7,000 updates a month in terms of what we have is different from the post office, and we're allowed to automatically update those based on that. Occasionally, we get data that isn't accurate, and we have the ability to reverse that decision essentially once we get feedback from the voter that they are they're not at the address that was given to us by the post office. I would assume that we would put some of the safeguards in place that we use with the NCOA with the DMV list, but that I'm sure has yet to be decided.
Okay, so just to follow up, so you don't see this as being an obstacle that's going to be very difficult to overcome, I mean, or apparently not a reason not to do it?
Chair Garrett, Representative Dembrough, I don't see it as an obstacle. I mean, we're talking about a pool of people who are not registered to vote currently and would be automatically opted in to the system. You know, we have notification cards that go out that are not forwardable. So if the person is not at that address and we get that card back, we can take action based on that.
Thank you.
Representative Berger.
Yes, what would be that action? Suppose someone was, what do you do about someone who's being stalked and has address, doesn't want a public record of their address, and how do you address those kinds of issues as you, and people have multiple addresses, which one, how do you determine that, and what would happen if, you know, you send a notice or the secretary sends a notice that says, you know, you're automatically in and you don't want to be in, but that for some reason that notice didn't get to the address that you're in. What how would all that work? Do you have a vision for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, so currently the protected voters that are on our list, that's really only I can the only thing that I can speak to. I don't really know how DMV handles that, but I assume that we would work together to identify those individuals so that their records were not transferred or remained confidential in the process. You know, we have limit, we can put limits on the system to what individuals can see. There's currently only one individual in my office out of 10 that can even see protected records, so they don't even have access to those other than to see that that person is a confidential voter. I'm sure that we would work with DMV to make sure that if a person has those protections in DMV but is not a registered voter, that we would honor those protections as the data came across.
Mr. Chair, I'm pointing out the danger here. How would he know that DMV, because then it's just automatically transferred, the DMV record, the voter in this case is not asked, do you want it transferred? It is transferred. And that is one of the dangers of this, in my opinion. Also, that person might not, I've made my point. I don't want to belabor it. Let someone else go on. And I know you're not, Mr. Chair, while I've got, I'm also a little bothered by the fact that I don't have the amendment, and nor do any of the people who have.
I think we do. It's on the list.
Okay, it is not on mine. And do the people who have? Do the people who have spoken to this bill understand that the bill is substantially changed? Because it's my understanding that it is not. It is a whole new concept,
right.
Basically.
Right.
So those people who have. I was reading through the testimony that we've received, and I'm not sure whether they which bill they're speaking to.
Right. Any further questions, comments? All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Janice Deisinger, Sandy Radu, and Rebecca Roth, please.
Good afternoon. I'm Janice Deisinger from Gresham Morgan. Thank you for hearing me, Chair Garrett and the committee members. I am against Bill 2198 as best that I know as it was online this morning. I haven't read the amendment. I want to say first of all that I am very pro-choice on this issue of voter registration. As a conservative, I think I just really like to make that clear that people need to have the option to register to vote or not, and we should respect that. I am concerned with the word change, at least as the bill was presented this morning, from changing the shells to maze for the voter registration agency. I think that we need to be very careful that our government bodies do not try to influence the voter in their registration. I think this will weaken our laws. This is multiple agencies doing the same work, so it's an additional fiscal problem. I saw in the law, as it was proposed online, that there would be verbal information that would be transferred And that's very difficult to get verbal information transferred from one department, from the voter to the department and then on to another department. That's difficult to do when it's given verbally, especially when you're talking names, spelling, and all that. And then I appreciated Representative Berger's comments very much earlier about automatically doing all of this with the privacy. And if we're going to, I told you in an earlier bill that there were 192,000 non-citizens that said they were non-citizens on the 2000 census. And so how are we going to identify all of those people to keep them from registering? When I had talked to the Secretary's office, especially with Mr. Trout, I asked if the database that was used to verify the driver's license and also the Social Security at that time, if that database excluded non-citizens, and they would not answer me. So I would encourage you to please ask if that table or a subsequent system that used a table, does that qualify the citizenship of the party that's voting, that's registering. So those are my main concerns, and I thank you very much for hearing me.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm Rebecca Roth, and I'm a precinct committee person, and also I collect signatures on various petitions. And in my work with collecting signatures, I'm supposed to identify people who are registered to vote. And they are supposed to be one of the petitions we turned in, there were people disqualified who had not recently voted on this particular petition. And with people being automatically registered to vote, it's going to create a great deal of confusion for what if I ask somebody, are you registered to vote? They may think they're registered to vote. According to this petition I worked on, if they haven't voted recently, they're an inactive voter. And we failed in our petition just simply because this was a rule made in the office of the Secretary of State that many voters didn't realize that when they said they were registered to vote and they hadn't voted recently and they signed our petition, it invalidated our petition. So it's important that that voters who think they're registered to vote are those that are going to be voting and that for the petition process, which is a great privilege here in Oregon. For signature collection also, I have run across people who are felons, and they may be able to go in and get a driver's license, but they should not be registered to vote. Also, I know some illegal aliens through other work that I do who have driver's licenses, and they should not be registered to vote. Once somebody is registered to vote, it is very difficult to convince the powers that be to take their name out of their voter registration. One of the things about having lots of names on the voter registration that are not current, they're just sitting there, they're names that are not active, is that they can be accessed by people to create false ballots. That's something that I hope never happens, but in a system where people can register to vote without having terrific ID, it does happen. There's people that will take a ballot that comes to their house and fill it out. There's people that get registered twice. I've had people get registered twice that I know. There's all kinds of things that already happen, and something that's just automatic like this, I think, is just asking for more trouble. Vote by mail does not have enough safeguards built into it already, and this is worse.
Thank you. Ms. Radu?
Representative Garrett, members of the committee, my name is Sandy Radu. I'm from Beaverton, Oregon, and today I'm talking totally as a private citizen. I am opposed to HB 2198 and its amendment, and for a lot of reasons. I've got all kinds of scribbles here, so bear with me. I would urge a no vote, basically, because to start with, changing the wording in the original bill from shall to may will leave some of the rules open to interpretation by state agencies who may or may not be, by the personnel who may or may not be familiar with exactly what they're doing by taking someone's signature, understanding that that information will be used down the road to register them to vote, even if it is Oregon Health Association or DHS records, as well as DMV. Voting is the most sacred right and privilege we have as Americans and as Oregonians. Voter registration should be the responsibility of the citizen, not the responsibility of state agencies. I have no issue with voter registration cards handed out anywhere and everywhere, any place we possibly can, to get them into the hands of eligible people. Put them in your grocery carts. I don't care. That's wonderful, but allow the voter to have the option of registering or not. It also keeps the burden off the state and off the taxpayer. Right now, Oregon statute defines residency requirements for a driver's license. One of the pieces of identification or residency information I can use to get a driver's license is a package with a first and last name sent from a verifiable business to an address. So I can order something off of Amazon, have it sent to an address, take that package into DMV, and get my address updated or my driver's license based on that residency requirement. Now, that's water under the bridge. That's stuff that it already allows people to register or to get a driver's license, which allows them to register to vote. But I maintain that with the laws that loose, taking one more level of responsibility and accountability out of the process is a bad thing. I'd also like to bring up the idea of the freedom of choice to register. As a PCP working in my neighborhood, I found many people said, I don't want to vote. I don't want anything to do with it. I hate you politicians. Get out of here. Leave me alone.
I've heard that too.
Yeah. And I would venture to guess that those people are going to be really upset when they find out they've been registered to vote. There's also religious objections, and as the lady next to me brought up, felons and all kinds of other things that I don't know that the responsibility falls on the state to verify. Also, the thing about inactive voters, do they automatically become active again if they're re-registered through this system? Also, the non-affiliated voters, unless they fill out their choice of party, even though they are registered to vote through this wonderful system, they wouldn't be eligible to vote in all elections. And I think there might be some education problems that would go on there. I strongly believe that each individual should have the right and the responsibility that if they care enough about their state, their city, their county, their country, that they would register to vote. I understand the goal of the Secretary of State is to be able to collect information from numerous state agencies. Currently, the motor voter requires the DMV to provide that information. No other agency should be permitted to do so. I believe that there's huge privacy risks and also possible violation of HIPAA laws if we get into the health exchanges and the health association and things like that. Anyway, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It strikes me from listening to the testimony there's about as much confusion between the bill that we will be asked to, apparently asked to vote on, and the one that people are testifying on. House Bill 2198 is written, and it is my understanding that the amendment that we have is the intended bill and not House Bill 2198 as originally written.
That's right.
The thing that kind of leads me to that, as folks were testifying, was the sometimes frequent reference to shall to may, which is not in, if I read through the amendment that we have. So, I mean absolutely no disrespect at all to those people who are here testifying on this. And, of course, it's possible that this committee might choose to pass 2198 as written and not, you know, with the amendment. I'm sure there are at least a couple of no votes on that, but it's still a possibility, so the testimony should still be taken seriously, you know, by us, you know, the committee. Representative Berger and I had a considerable amount of discussion about this bill when we were reading 2198 as written. Only then later to discover that we were arguing about something that wasn't planned to be part of the bill. It just started out as a vehicle, you know, for the bill. So I don't know. I suppose that amendment should be online now, and would encourage you to, you know, have a look at that.
We can run. I couldn't see it.
Thank you, Representative. Okay, thank you to the panel. We have two more witnesses, Emma Calloway and Cappy Eaton. I also just want to let the committee know that I have asked the Secretary of State's office to send us a letter or memo that responds to some of the concerns that have been raised. I think the security issues are legitimate and important, and we want to have further discussion of those. Yes,
in that regard, I was going to ask, I'd like information on how things like citizenship would be verified and felonies and other things that would make people ineligible to vote, so
Secretary
that we would be sure we're not contaminating the voting record.
She's nodding her head yes, so we will have that addressed as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Representative Garrett and members of the committee, my name is Emma Calloway. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Student Association, and typically would have students testify as opposed to myself, but it's finals week, so I'm here on their behalf. I wanted to speak in support of 2198 today, with the caveat, obviously, that I think we should be answering questions about security and verification. I think that that's important. But specifically from the student perspective, we looked at this bill, and students on community college and university campuses are some of the most transient populations in this state. I would say that at bare minimum, students move on an annual basis, which means that they're constantly having to update their voter registration. And we're noticing that students and young people, although students of all ages are part of the Oregon Student Association, tend to fall through the cracks. And that's kind of what this bill is able to fix, because it's able to actually share information and allow people to have that opportunity to have their address change when they change with their driver's license to be able to be part of this bill. We think that this is especially important in communities where there's less emphasis on voter registration from partisan groups. We know that in smaller communities, when you're actually, you know, a particular party may not send out as many folks out to La Grande, Oregon as they would in Portland to register folks to vote. And we know that we spend a lot of time trying to do nonpartisan voter registration in smaller communities where there isn't as much advertising about voter registration dates, there isn't as much information. And I did hear from a member who's not in support of this bill say that if people cared about their country or their community, that they would register to vote. But honestly, students are often don't register to vote or are not updated to register to vote because they don't know where, when, or how. And we think that this bill would help to kind of fill in some of those gaps and help to solve the problem of students, young people, falling through the cracks. So thank you very much. I'm happy to take any questions, but that's our perspective.
Thank you.
Thanks. Chair Garrett, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cappy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters. The League recognizes that election procedures and voter information are critical elements to an informed and participating electorate. There are two or three things I'd really like to bring to your attention. We believe that 2198 offers an improved registration process, which is accessible and easily understood, as well as being easy to implement and to administer. It also moves forward the National Voting Rights Act with a secure system that removes the barriers to the ballot. It increases ballot security, and it collects the registration information required by the state and federal laws. Essential to a proposed modernization process such as this is a voter verification procedure and the ability of verified voters to choose whether or not to participate. The notice sent to voters also will offer the opportunity to indicate a choice of political parties or non-affiliation. We did a recent study on election methods in the League, and we agreed that there should be some evaluation criteria looking at the methods for registration, promotion of voter participation, simplicity and ease of understanding, verifiable and auditable information, and be compatible with the vote-by-mail system. And we believe that House Bill 2198 lives up to those criteria. It's time to use a secure and available technology to update and improve Oregon's voter registration process, and particularly to increase voter participation with more people participating in our elections. Thank you for this opportunity to comment.
Thank you both. Representative Berger.
Yes, Cappy and Ms. Emma, are you speaking to the base bill or the amendments?
I'm speaking to it, how it will be when it's amended.
Okay. In other words, Cappy, the League has considered the fact that people would be automatically registered whether they have asked to be registered or not, and they have opined on that?
Representative Berger, we're very much committed to having as many people who are eligible to vote, vote. And if this increases the ability to participate, yes.
Thank you. And you, Emma, you agree that your students want to be registered whether they have been asked whether they want to register or not?
Representative Garrett and Representative Berger, thank you for the question. We are supportive of as many people being registered to vote as possible. And
that was not what I asked either of you.
We're supportive of the amendments to the bill.
You are supportive of the amendments. And Cappy, your organization is supportive of the amendments?
Yes.
Thank you.
I see no further questions. Thank you both. That concludes our testimony on this bill. So we'll close a public hearing on House Bill 2198. We have one more bill to hear today. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3077. Ms. Seiler, please explain the bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3077 enacts Oregon's participation in Interstate Compact for election of U.S. President by national popular vote, provides that compact takes effect when enacted by states cumulatively possessing a majority of all electoral votes, establishes procedures requiring chief election official of each state participating in the compact to separately determine national popular vote winner, certify the electoral slate nominated in that state in association with the national popular vote winner, and provides mechanism for state to withdraw from compact, terminates compact if electoral college is abolished. We have a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact on the measure. And just for a point of reference, we did receive books at the dais. I have emailed you a link to that same book online.
All right, thank you. We'll start with Justin Martin. And Dr. Koza, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Hoyle, Vice Chair Hicks, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin, and I'm here today on behalf of National Popular Vote. With me is Dr. Koza, who is going to go into detail about the plan, but I would like to share some important statistics and talk about why this bill is relevant to Oregonians. First, the National Popular Vote bill has passed in 9 jurisdictions: Maryland, Massachusetts, Vermont, New Jersey, the District of Columbia, Illinois, and western states of Washington, California, and Hawaii. That those states possess 132 electoral votes, which is 49% of the amount of electoral votes needed to trigger this interstate compact that you will hear from in just a moment. The bill has also passed at least one chamber in 12 states, including Oregon, in 2009, and it has been endorsed by 2,142 of your colleagues around the country. Why is this relevant to Oregon? Well, as you will hear from Dr. Koza, with the winner-take-all system that we have in place in Oregon, Oregon, along with 40 other states, were completely ignored in the 2012 presidential election. We had zero campaign visits. By comparison, the state of Florida had 73 visits. The state of Florida had 40 visits, the state of Ohio had 73 visits, and the state of Virginia had 36 visits. Why is that important? It's important not just on the front end of campaigns. It's also important on the governance side. Once a president gets into the White House, what issues do they look at? What issues do they focus on? And what is their concentration? The reality is it's usually senior issues for Florida votes, Medicare Part D, for example, or it's No Child Left Behind looking at soccer moms in Ohio. When in essence, if every vote mattered in every state, we could be talking about issues that are relevant to Oregon and the West, issues like immigration, issues like Pacific Rim trade, issues like natural resources, and issues like the high-tech industry. We hope with passage of this bill that we can put Oregon on the map. We also feel that the 754,000 Republican votes that were cast for the Republican candidate in Oregon in 2012 should be counted. Regardless of anyone's position in opposition or in favor of this bill today, I think we all in this room could agree, we all in this state could probably agree, and everybody across the country would agree that every vote should be equal. You're going to hear a lot of testimony that will try to confuse and complicate this issue through myths, scenarios, and theories. We've taken a great deal of steps within our book. Chapter 9 is 431 pages addressing all these myths, scenarios, and theories. And at the end of the day, after you hear all of this testimony and all of those things, I always come back to the fact of what the National Popular Vote Bill is really all about. It's simple and it's not complicated. It would ensure that every vote in every state matters in every presidential election, and that the candidate who gets the most votes would win. So, Mr. Chair, thank you very much for this opportunity, and today we hope you will support House Bill 3077, and with that, I'll introduce Dr. John Koza, the founder of National Popular Vote.
Thank you very much. Dr. Koza, welcome.
Yes, thank you, Chairman Garrett, and Vice Chair Hoyle, and Vice Chair Hicks, and the rest of the committee. I'm the chair of National Popular Vote.
I need your name for the record, please.
And my name is John Koza, K-O-Z-A. The main shortcoming of the current system of electing the president is this winner-take-all rule, which has the practical effect of leaving 40 of the 50 states, including Oregon, out of the general election campaign. Because once a candidate is clearly ahead in Oregon or clearly behind in Idaho, there's no point paying attention to issues relevant to Idaho or Oregon, or for that matter, if you look at the map that's contained in the testimony, there are only two western states, Colorado and Nevada, that received any attention in the presidential campaign. The attention from presidential candidates is highly skewed. Iowa, which is a much smaller state than Oregon, had 27 of the 253 general election campaign visits. That's 10% of all the visits in one state, whereas Connecticut and Oregon and Oklahoma, which are seven electoral states, received none. What does this mean? Well, it translates into a lot of things. It translates into 5% less federal grant money that's under control of the White House, and 7% fewer grants. It translates into Superfund decisions that are skewed in favor of the battleground states. It translates into twice as many federal disaster declarations under the Stafford Act, regardless of party, by the way, regardless of who's president. And as has been said about the No Child Left Behind law, it really is no swing state left behind. So what this bill is an interstate compact. It's an agreement among the states. It's a contract among the states, like many of the interstate compacts that Oregon is a member of. And a contract has pluses and minuses. What is the plus? The plus is if you believe that Oregon issues and Oregon voters ought to be given attention in a presidential campaign, then you as state legislators have the exclusive power under the Constitution to change the way you award your electoral votes. And you can change to the way provided in this act, which says that Oregon would give its electoral votes to the presidential candidate who gets the most popular votes in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. That would also mean, by the way, that the first place candidate would always win the White House, something that doesn't always happen. But the main point is that it would make every vote in every state politically relevant in every single presidential election. That's what you gain. What do you lose? There are seven people in Oregon who go come up here to Salem on December 15th. They spend about 30 minutes here casting their expected votes for president, which in recent years have meant that seven Democrats have come to Salem and cast Oregon's seven electoral votes for the Democratic presidential nominee. As you know, Democrats win about half the presidential elections and Republicans win about half. So about half the time, you will have Republican electors coming to Salem and half the time Democrats. So what you lose is what these seven people gain in the way of this honorary position. What you gain is relevance to Oregon issues in the presidential campaign. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative
Barnhart. Excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of different things. I'm confused, I think. My understanding is that you would still have electors coming to Salem on December 15th to vote, but the choice of those electors would be determined not by the outcome of the vote in Oregon, but by the outcome of the popular vote nationwide. Have I understood that correctly, or did what you just say, is that something new?
You did understand that correctly.
Thank
you. The purpose of the bill is to guarantee the White House the candidate who gets the most votes in all 50 states.
Thank you. Different topic, if I could.
Different topic.
There's been in the news lately a whole lot of discussion about the possibility of having electors elected by congressional districts in some states. It just so happens that at least the ones I know about, there may be others that I don't know about, but at least the ones I know about are states in which there is significant gerrymandering of congressional districts by the legislature that result in districts that tend to send members of one party to the Congress significantly out of proportion to the actual votes statewide in those states. One can assume that the same thing would happen if the presidential electors were chosen by gerrymandered congressional districts. Does this proposal help deal with that issue, irrelevant to that issue, or what does it suggest? Assuming that you got enough states to agree to it so that it went into effect?
Well, Chairman Garrett and Representative Barnhart, this bill has nothing to do with awarding electoral votes by congressional district.
Oh, I understand
which,
that.
Which is a method that is allowed under the Constitution and is used by Maine and Nebraska at the current time. This bill is relevant to that, however, because it is, in effect, an alternative way of electing the president. And to the extent that, hopefully by 2016, this bill is passed by enough states to represent 270 more electoral votes, then this bill would preclude any practical effect of states switching, and you're talking about states like that have been in the news recently, like Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin, states switching to the congressional district system, they could still switch, and their votes would still be counted among the 50 states that would determine the national popular vote under our bill. But this bill would negate the practical effect of say, if Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, or Ohio, Virginia, Florida were to adopt the district system. It would negate the practical effect of that.
Thank you. And then a final thing, again, a third topic, and I apologize for jumping all around, but it sounds like what you're saying is presidential candidates who wanted to maximize their outcome nationwide would find it tempting to come visit Oregon because doing so would have could have the effect of maximizing the vote for that candidate in Oregon, even if it did not have the effect of swinging Oregon itself into that candidate's column. And therefore, there'd be an advantage to coming here.
Well, Representative Garrett and Barnhart, you're correct. If you were the Republican nominee for president, you would no longer ignore Oregon, because there's 754,000 Oregonians who did vote Republican, and you would like to raise that number or at least keep it up at that level. And if you were a Democrat, instead of taking Oregon for granted and ignoring Oregon issues, you would come here because you would want to maintain the number of votes that the previous Democrat got in Oregon, or at least raise it, or hope and certainly make sure it didn't go down. So all of a sudden, high-tech and Pacific Rim trade and natural resources environment, issues peculiar to Oregon and generally the whole West, would become relevant. They're not relevant now because
it simply doesn't matter to the White House.
Those issues. Nevada issues matter. Colorado issues matter. Iowa issues matters. But the fact is that two-thirds of all the attention, two-thirds of all the visits and money went into just four states in the last election, and virtually all of it went into 10 states. And 40 states were left out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, gentlemen. And I look forward to our chance to get to sit down in my office and discuss these particulars. I've yet to make it through. Working on it. I recognize that that you're not undoing, per se, the Electoral College. It will remain intact, and that's very, very important. I do think, though, my principal concern at the moment is that I think you're undoing one of the purposes of the Electoral College. And I don't know how often you hear this or how often people say it, but I actually do feel the Electoral College serves a very relevant purpose, one of the same purposes that it was originally established to serve. And that is, it prevents voting blocks from forming along regional or demographic lines across state lines. And what I'm saying is, a candidate could, in the scenario contemplated by national popular vote, well, let me back up from that. A candidate could, without the Electoral College in place, tell a certain region of the country that they can have everything they want, and the rest of the country is just going to have to deal with the consequences. Let's say it's the South, okay? All they would have to do would be to convince enough voters in the South that they can have everything they want and to win the election. And then the rest of the nation gets frozen out. The Electoral College breaks that up. The Electoral College prevents that kind of scenario from occurring. Yeah, I think it was very important at the founding of the nation that that not be permitted to happen. Another thing, you know, take it up, fast forward to today's more kind of consequential scenario. It's been said rightly or wrongly, accurately or otherwise, and I don't know, but some people say that 51% of Americans don't pay income tax or something along those lines. Okay, so for argument's sake, let's say that that's accurate. So a candidate could tell 51% of the nation's residents, regardless of which state they lived in under a national popular vote scenario, that they get to have whatever they want, the 51% that don't pay income taxes, okay? And that candidate would win every time. And the rest of the people, the other 49%, wouldn't get the representation that they're currently getting. So I think that this undoes, ultimately, it undoes a lot of what a lot of the protections that are in place for basically running away with the elections. I'm very concerned about that.
Now, Representative Garrett and Representative Hicks, there's nothing in the fact that the candidates focus down on 10 states that prevents them from addressing demographic groups. We know, for example, that 72% of Hispanics supported the incumbent president last time. That would probably be true in all 50 states, as it was true in the 10 battleground states. We've all heard about the 47% and the 51%. Candidates make appeals all the time. There are people in Ohio that listened to those appeals in Florida and Virginia. They simply didn't make those appeals to the rest of the country. And as we all know, a candidate cannot say a single thing in a single place during a presidential campaign that isn't heard by 100% of the people the next morning on YouTube or somewhere else. So I don't think the Electoral College does a thing. It certainly does nothing for the South. If you look at this map, except for Florida, Virginia, and North Carolina, South is totally ignored. The border states are totally ignored. The central Midwestern states are ignored. And the mountain West states are ignored. And in fact, all the Western states are ignored except Nevada and Colorado. So where's the protection that the Electoral College is delivering? It's simply causing 40 states to be ignored and focusing all the attention of the White House on 10 states. And they were focused on those 10 states since November of 2008, as soon as the election returns were closed, just as their predecessors were, George Bush, as soon as he took the oath of office, as soon as his hand came down, he was giving steel quotas to Pennsylvania, even though he's the free trade president from the free trade party. He wasn't ignoring the fact that Pennsylvania was a closely divided battleground state, and to hell with free trade principles.
I think it's basically happened in our nation's history. I think the Electoral College has prevented one region. I think it was 1884, 1888. I forget. I'm not a presidential scholar. I think that it's been attempted in our nation's history for a region to try and take over the federal government by simply winning all the popular vote, and the Electoral College prevented that from occurring. So I haven't made it through the book yet. But it works. It serves that purpose even today. National popular vote would undo that.
Chairman Garrett and Vice Chair Hicks, if you turn to page 502, I realize you haven't had a chance to you can look at the famous 1888 election,
okay. And
you can see that, in fact, Grover Cleveland was a regional candidate. You see all that black stuff in the South and running up to Connecticut on the Atlantic, a contiguous regional election. And the Electoral College didn't elect him. But it didn't do a good job of preventing regionalism, because if you look at the rest of the map, you'll notice that the candidate who did get elected, who had fewer votes, which was Benjamin Harrison, he also was the regional candidate. So all the Electoral College did was transfer the White House from the first place regional candidate, Grover Cleveland, to the second place regional candidate, Benjamin Harrison. And as for protecting against regionalism, take a look at the 2012 map. It looks damn similar to the 1888 map. Regionalism is alive and well in the country. And if we're waiting for the Electoral College to protect us against regionalism, we've been waiting a long time. And I think we're going to wait a lot longer.
Follow up, and then we should move on.
Okay, I do want the Electoral College to continue to protect us against demographicism, put it that way. I don't feel that this keeps that intact. I don't. I like the protections that I am perceiving the Electoral College and the state lines that it maintains against demographicism, which is the modern version of regionalism, I think, on a certain level. Okay, I'm done.
All right. Further, Representative Jensen.
something bothers chose, as they were putting this country together, the Electoral College system.
Representative Garrett and Jensen, this was a complicated process. It took the whole Constitutional Convention. They were debating how to elect the president. Slavery was a big factor. It was impossible to consider a popular election for president because the great mass of people in southern part of the country didn't vote, and they would have had almost no representation in a popular vote because most of the people weren't voting. And by the way, most of the white men were not voting in the South. The requirements to vote in the South were extremely high in terms of wealth. So like 3,000 votes were cast in Georgia in the first presidential election. So that's one factor. The founders thought they were setting up a deliberative body, much like the College of Cardinals. In fact, that's what the Electoral College is modeled after, where distinguished, rich white males from the community, well-known people, would sit and deliberate and judiciously pick the best candidate for president. And that's what they thought they were setting up. You can read Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 68. He says these small assemblies of distinguished gentlemen will judiciously deliberate, blah, blah, blah. Well, that was fine for the Federalist Papers, but as soon as practical politics came into play and there were competing candidates, by 1796, there was no deliberation. 165 of the 166 presidential electors voted exactly according to the party that had picked them, and the deliberative Electoral College never really existed. So they thought they were setting up a deliberative body that was going to sort of, without politics, pick the best person. And what we got was a system where the political parties pick longtime activists, contributors, office holders to come to Salem and cast their votes dutifully for their own political party's nominee.
Follow up. How long has, in history, how long has the United States been a democratic democracy? How long has our system of democracy been in existence?
Chairman Garrett and Representative Jensen, it depends how you define it. Remember, women didn't vote till 1919.
No.
So
there are some people today that we don't let vote to.
Right,
if they're
right.
Under 18, they don't get to vote.
I'm not sure how to answer your question, but the winner-take-all rule took about 50 years after the Constitution to become predominant. Maybe that helps.
Follow-up.
Follow-up.
If I had had the benefit of the professional training of the first three males to my left, having all gone to law school, in response to the first question I asked, when you said, and I think pretty close to a quote, but I'll just say a paraphrase, it's a complicated process, I have said the defense rests. I think the system we have has withstood the test of time and history in some extremely troublesome times. We went through things like the American Civil War, and nothing in any country could be more challenging for the survival, the basic survival of your country, than to have a civil war of the magnitude that one was in this country. We survived that.
The system isn't perfect, but none of the other systems have survived as long as we have.
Representative Berger, and then maybe if you want to make a final response, and then we should move on to our other witnesses because we're coming up on final half hour.
I, with great respect to my friend, the representative from District 58, there have been substantial changes in our way of thinking about our democracy, and one of its great powers is its ability to be flexible when change is necessary. As the gender that was not enfranchised for the first, 125 years of our democracy, I think that we need to recognize that its perfection will never be achieved, but we need to be mindful that as things change, and things have changed dramatically in my lifetime in terms of the way things, just the technology alone has been so dramatic, that I think it is appropriate for us to look at the way 10 states basically decide for us what issues are important in this country. This is untenable to me. I would prefer that Congress send out a constitutional change. That would be my first choice. And we could, as a nation, decide whether we value the Electoral College or not. Not given that option by Congress, I have been a sponsor of this bill because I believe we have a lot of issues in this country, and a lot of them never are brought to the table in our current electoral system because we aren't doing national popular vote. We aren't relevant. Only those 10 states are. So while it would be ideal that I could vote on this as a constitutional change out of Congress, not given that option, I want Oregon to matter, and this is a vehicle that I support. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Jensen, and then we need to move on.
I just want to respond that this is not a work session.
So no, we are not moving this bill today.
Response to that at this point.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Koza, for being here. We appreciate it. let's see. Why don't we bring forward Andrew Nesbitt, Patrick Laswell, and Trent England, please.
And again, members, as these gentlemen conferred, we have received written testimony is available on OLIS from Annette Eschenbrenner, John Barbara, Ruth Bindle, Violet Emlyn Burton, Connie Dunham, Janice Deisinger, Kathy Eaton, Darlene France, Jim Hubbard, Patrick Laswell, Mike and Annette Lanthrop, Andrew Nesbitt, Tara Ross, Kate Titus, Kurt White, Fred Yates, Wendy Frohm, and Christine Ruck.
So we've got about half an hour. We have nine people on the list, and I'll just ask that you try and be concise. If you have submitted written testimony, don't read it. We'll have it. You can feel free to hit the high points and summarize it for us.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Andrew Nesbitt, Portland, Oregon. The constitutional issues that haven't been addressed worry me a great deal. The compact is a compact as defined in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3. It doesn't meet the standards established in Virginia v. Tennessee that determined what sorts of compact states can enter into without requiring congressional approval. It doesn't have congressional approval. The problem is that if the people who brought this bill forward agreed with me that it is unconstitutional, I would imagine that they weren't going to do it, and this room does not seem to me to be a probable location for making a final determination of the constitutionality of anything. There are a couple of things about the bill that worry me a great deal outside of that. The first thing is that with the exception of South Carolina, no state legislature has chosen who the electors were going to be. presidential electors were going to be since the election of 1832. With good intent and doubtless Democratic enthusiasm, that's what we're going to be doing if this bill passes. The voters in Oregon will send their votes out into the fog, and then the legislature will choose who the voters, the electors are by the mechanism set forward in this bill. If we're going to do that, what we really should do is make this bill into a referendum and see what the citizens of Oregon feel about that particular mechanism. It worries me that the bill nationalizes corruption and localizes enforcement. There's a clause in this that says that we are pre-committed to accepting as legitimate any vote totals that are generated by the appropriate authorities in any state. What that means is that it is perfectly possible that the city of Chicago could accidentally triple its population and have all of them vote three times, and unless the Secretary of State for Illinois chooses to enforce that or to delete that fraudulence, we're stuck with it. We will have, by this compact, agreed that we will accept whatever results are generated by the other states in the union. I believe if you want to look at it, it would be page 2, line 14 through 16, if you want to take a glance. I don't know what the Supreme Court will decide if and when this ever comes to a head. I can, however, guarantee you that if it becomes operational, it will come to a head. Someone will challenge it, and we know when that is going to occur. It's going to occur in December of a presidential election year. I don't know about the members of the committee, but I did not love Florida in 2000 so much that I want to schedule a rerun. And that's it from me.
Thank you.
Patrick Boswell, I'm chair of the Voter Integrity Project for the Multnomah County Republican Party. I'm reasonably certain that elections that occur under my scrutiny are fair and honest, reasonably certain. The rest of the country, voter fraud is rampant, wildly so. The woman in Ohio under indictment for her six votes, and Maryland Representative Jim Moran's son, who forged power bills to generate additional voter registrations and got caught on tape doing so. This marginalizes Oregonians for being honest. Instead of the 100% of the way the presidential vote went in 39 districts in Pennsylvania last time, there's nothing in this that prevents us from having to accept 200, 500, 900, who knows. This has no mechanism for managing fraud. We know fraud exists. This makes us exceptionally vulnerable. It marginalizes us as a state. And as a small state, it throws away our slight but real advantage in electoral votes. The Electoral College is certainly flawed in a variety of directions, but it prevents 700% returns from mattering in the presidential election.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Trent England from the Freedom Foundation of Washington State. I'm glad to be here to talk about something that I've been fascinated with, actually running back before the 2000 election. I was interested in the topic of the Electoral College. I want to echo a little bit what's been said and then maybe make the argument a little bit more broadly. But one of the really unusual things about this compact is that while it talks about having a national popular vote, you would actually, if you look at the compact, you would have 51 different national popular votes, right? Each state would certify that result for itself. And the problem is, this is politics, right? And so the problems mentioned just a moment ago, I think you you have to go even beyond that, right? The reality is you're asking state-elected officials to certify the returns for other states, and as soon as there's a serious dispute about what those are, whether it's real or whether it's political, right, whether it's people watching Fox News or MSNBC and being told, you know, we think they're stealing votes in Texas or we think they're stealing votes in Illinois, you have a real problem. And the poorest thing about the drafting of the NPV Interstate Compact is that it says nothing about how you decide any disputes. It tries to address disputes by essentially shutting its eyes to the fact that in politics we have close elections, we have disputes, we have disagreements. That's sort of why we have politics. And I mean, one example that I find just intriguing, it makes no provision for how you would even think about recounts or adjudicate the results of recounts, yet it does have a provision for what you do if there's an absolute tie in the national popular vote. Right? I mean, it's an odd compact. And the larger point is, and the reason I've been fascinated with this for a long time, is we're talking about the most important elected office in the world. Right? Not just in the country, but in the world. And we're talking about the largest functioning, longest functioning representative republic in the world, with a large landmass, a large population, a diverse population. The Electoral College has worked for us for a long time, and the greatest thing about even the flaws of the Electoral College is that we understand what they are. We have precedents for dealing with them. And the reality, I was glad that it wasn't mentioned. Oftentimes, National Popular Vote likes to mention that we've had these wrong winner elections. But Representative Hicks was absolutely right. If you look at previous elections that are supposedly wrong winner, 1876 shows how the Electoral College uses states as the equivalent of watertight compartments on an ocean liner, isolating real election fraud and a side election dispute actually from this state where you inadvertently chose a postmaster to be an elector. Those things were able to be isolated and dealt with. Going to a sort of ad hoc, compact created national popular vote does nationalize all the problems, and then Congress is not in a position anymore to say, well, we're going to set this state's electoral votes aside and look into this fraud as they did in 1876 and actually deal with that problem. As soon as you nationalize those problems, you put us in a very different world for national elections. In 1876, just not to belabor the point, but the Electoral College prevented racist vote suppression from stealing the presidency. Right? In an NPV world in 1876, racist vote suppression would almost certainly have stolen the presidency. And because of the Electoral College, that election dispute was able to be sorted out by Congress in a way that made a lot of people unhappy, but at least it prevented the vote fraud from throwing the election. Finally, I'll conclude on the 1888 point, because this does go to the issue that was raised before. And I think this is the most important. Our elections are, our politics is like an ecosystem, right? You can't change something and not expect the whole ecosystem to reorder itself. It's a system of incentives. It's a system in motion. And when we think about presidential elections and when we think about this, and ultimately whatever side you come down, the question is not, how many bricks of good intentions are in this road that NPV is paving for us. The question is where it goes and what the effects are, what the incentives are that it creates. I submit to you, unless NPV is going to dramatically increase the amount of money in politics or the length of the campaigns, it doesn't mean that suddenly every voter is going to have a personal relationship with all the candidates like they get to do in New Hampshire during the primaries. It shuffles the deck. It means that candidates will go to different places, but they will not be everywhere. Right? You may get more focus in a part of Oregon. You may get less focus overall. You may get more focus overall. Right? Certainly in some states, they'll get less. In the election of 1888...
I need to ask you to kind of wrap it
certainly,
up now, please.
The election of 1888 is the perfect example to this point of both regionalism and radicalism. The outcome of that election is the reason why the Democratic Party said, look, we don't need the Klan vote, right? We don't need the extreme vote in the South. We can win the South not with 84%, but 60% is fine, 55% is fine. We're going to reach out to groups that were being ignored by Republicans in northern cities, especially recent immigrants from Catholic countries, and build their coalition that way. That's the kind of incentive the Electoral College gives us. There are some real questions about how NPV changes that, and they really should be answered, I think, before the compact.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Happy to take questions.
All right. Well, we have a few more witnesses to get through. Thank you, all three of you. Janice Deisinger, Jeff Grossman, please.
Representative Garrett and members of the committee, thank you for hearing me. I'm Janice Steisinger from Gresham, Oregon. I'll be very brief. I wanted to just say that as a citizen, changing the definition of election results is very concerning to me. To have them be something other than the addition of a tally is most distressing for me. I think by keeping the current status that we have of the Electoral College, where the votes are accumulated in one state, and recognizing the winner of that state recognizes the state's right to autonomy instead of awarding our votes to someone else that we didn't vote for as Oregonians. I also want to point out that ORS 183.750 says that a state agency is required to prepare public writings in a readable form. Every state agency shall prepare in writing its language that is clear and simple as possible. And I know I'm not the brightest person in the world, but I felt that the statute, the bill, was not really easy to follow, to find out that the chief election officer was going to be able to choose and award our votes to another state. So I have a problem as far as the clearness of this statute.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Grossman, I see you have written testimony. So
I handed out written testimony. Excuse me. I will not duplicate the written testimony as much as possible. My name is Jeff Grossman. I'm speaking on opposition to this bill on behalf of the Oregon Republican Party, and also representing the stated position of the Republican National Committee. In all cases in which the popular and electoral results differed, except for Bush and Gore over a century ago, for the past 100 years, the Electoral College has functioned without incident in every presidential election through two world wars, major economic depression, several periods of acute unrest. Such stability, rare in human history, should not be lightly dismissed. All of them were resolved in a peaceful and orderly fashion. The concept of a civil war, public uprising over elections, it's just not in our DNA. I wouldn't want to imagine how that would happen with a direct election of the president. The important thing to remember about the Electoral College is that it imposes two requirements on the presidency: that a voter obtain a sufficient popular vote to enable a president to govern, although it doesn't have to be an absolute majority, in almost all cases it has been. But the second thing is that the Electoral College imposes a requirement that the popular vote be sufficiently distributed across the country to give the president a mandate to govern. So far from being flawed, any historical oddities demonstrate the strength and resilience of the Electoral College. Now, as has been said, the NPV compact places Oregon's electoral votes at the mercy of not only other states' votes, but on the accuracy and integrity of their election. Although we can't challenge other states' votes, they can be challenged within those states. So it begs the question, if the vote is close and each state is being challenged, when are we going to see white smoke? Now, there are two key issues, and I'm only going to talk about one of them here. The other is in my written testimony, which is fairness. Oregon voters are firstly independent and have not voted for Republican presidents since Ronald Reagan, much to my disappointment, because I've been a presidential elector candidate three times in the past election, never got to vote. To the Democrats on this committee, let me consider the following question. How will you explain to the citizens of this state that our precious seven electoral votes were cast for a Republican president, even though they voted for a Democrat candidate? How will you justify that fundamental unfairness? To the Republicans on this committee, consider this question. Should the Republican candidate win the aggregate popular vote, but Oregon votes for a Democrat candidate, how can you in good conscience accept Oregon's electoral votes? How would you justify the fundamental unfairness? And besides, because the electoral vote and the popular vote so rarely are out of sync, in that scenario, a Republican presidential candidate's not likely to need Oregon votes anyway. That concludes my oral statements. I would be happy to take questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Really appreciate your testimony. Any questions for this panel? Thank you both. Cappy Eaton and Kate Titus, please.
Here, Garrett, I did submit written testimony. Would you prefer that I leave it at that?
Feel free to, you know, hit the high points of your testimony as long as you're here. We'd like to hear from you. I'm hoping we might be able to have a couple minutes at the end for Dr. Koza,
Chair Garrett, since he's here from out of town. For the record, my name is Cappy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I will be very brief. The League just wholeheartedly supports this bill. In fact, we amended our position on the Electoral College in 2010 in the National Convention because we were so convinced that every vote should count across all 50 states. And so our long-range position with regard to the election of the presidency is that the Electoral College should be abolished. But we changed our, we amended our position to say that national popular vote was a way in which we could get at the direct election of the president, which is our basic position that the president of the United States should be elected by popular vote, not whether or not 60,000 votes in the Ohio presidential election in 2004, if changed, 60,000 votes for Senator Kerry would have carried the Electoral College, but in fact, the national vote was for President Bush. So there have been four presidential elections over our history where the person who did not receive the national popular vote, in fact, was elected president. And very personally, I'm tired of being ignored. Presidential candidates come into the state of Oregon now to collect some money for a couple of fundraisers, and that's all we see of them. 98% of the campaign money goes to six states. Two-thirds of the states are totally ignored. And in this kind of a government that we have, it's important that every vote counts. And so one of the reasons that we support it is because it equals across the states the voices of the smaller states, and we are a smaller state. We are, in essence, a spectator to the national elections. So we strongly believe in the League that every vote should count, and the national popular vote in the Interstate Compact is a very important way to get that accomplished. Thank you.
Thank you both.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, mm-hmm. Thank you for taking my testimony. For the record, my name is Kate Titus, and I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Oregon. And in the essence of time, I'll be brief and just highlight the main points of my written testimony. But, Common Cause has worked for many years to strengthen public participation and faith in our institutions of self-government. And we feel that electing a president is one of the core fundamental acts of self-government. It's where we publicly debate our priorities and direction as a nation. And right now, the way the system is set up across the country, every vote does not count equally. And states like Oregon are virtually ignored in the presidential debate in terms of campaigning, but more importantly, in terms of the public debate that happens around the presidential election. So we support the national popular vote bill and solution. We think it would solve that problem, and it would improve our presidential election system in several very important ways. First, it makes every vote equal. National popular vote forces candidates to appeal to every voter for their vote, rather than focusing on just electoral votes in a few swing states. Second, it puts Oregon back on the map. National popular vote incentivizes a full 50-state presidential race with political campaigns engaging with voters across the country and having a broader public discussion of issues that's not skewed by marginal issues of relatively small groups of voters in swing states. Third, it increases voter participation, as voters were more motivated to vote when we feel like our vote really matters and less so when we don't. And battleground states see an increase of voter participation. And finally, it increases voter confidence. I think that all Americans have a deeply ingrained sense of democratic fair play. It may be naive, but I think we would like to think that the person who wins the most votes actually is going to win the presidency. And that has played out consistently in polling, that there's strong support here in Oregon and nationally for national popular vote. I just close by pointing out that this is neither a liberal or a conservative proposal. I think it's something that can garner support from all of us in the interest of a well-functioning democracy. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Final two witnesses are Tim Cowan and Sandy Radu.
Mr. Chair, can I just provide written?
That'd be fine. Yeah. Thank you very much.
I will be very brief. Chair Garrett, members of the committee, they're remaining. The whole notion of national popular vote is to make Oregon count.
Need your name for the record.
I'm sorry, Sandy Radu, yeah. Beaverton, Oregon. The whole notion of it is to make every vote count and make Oregon count and be less relevant. I would like to ask those members of the committee that live outside the Multnomah County area how relevant their counties feel, with Multnomah County being the most populous county in the state. And as Multnomah County goes, the state goes. Why do we think that Oregon will all of a sudden be relevant when we have places nearby like Los Angeles, San Francisco, Chicago, New York, large population areas that will get the majority of the attention? It won't just be chasing electoral votes, it'll be chasing real votes. But why would a candidate come to Oregon, where we have less people statewide than you may have in a large metropolitan area? That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. In our remaining time, since Dr. Coase is here from out of town, I'd like to bring him back up and see if we can. I have a question for you, actually, based on the conversation we've heard, and the other members may as well. Dr. Coase, I was wondering if you could address the concern that we've heard that the national popular vote makes Oregon vulnerable to voting irregularities in other states, you know, that type of mischief that would that we may or may not exist to various degrees in other states, but, you know, the argument that makes us vulnerable to that in a way that we're not currently.
Well, as we all know, Oregon has an admirably accurate election system. I saw a quotation just this morning from the former Republican state chair of Oregon, saying that it was brutally accurate, and you should be proud of that. And as one of the previous witnesses pointed out, there are instances of election fraud and shenanigans in places like Ohio and Pennsylvania. Unfortunately, Oregon is already subject to that fraud, because those are the closely divided battleground states that determine who goes to the White House. 73 of the 253 general election campaign events were in Ohio. So what happens in Ohio already affects Oregon. There was specific mention to the clause of the compact, which says that the election returns from certified by the state official would be considered conclusive. Well, we got that wording from the existing federal law that's been in place since the 1876 election. It's Section 5 of Title 3 of the United States Code, and you can read it on page 266. But what current federal law has said for the last 130 years is that the election returns that come out of a state through whatever judicial review that may exist in that state or in federal courts will be binding on Congress if they're completed 6 days before the Electoral College meet. It's the so-called safe harbor clause. So there's nothing novel in the National Popular Vote Compact in terms of subjecting Oregon to decisions made in other states. You are already subject to those decisions, and your remedy is through judicial action that might go up to the U.S. Supreme Court or conceivably could be settled by Congress. But there's no change. We just copied existing federal law, and there's nothing novel about what we did.
Vice Chair Hicks, you're welcome to deal with any other issues that came up, but I know Vice Chair Hicks has a couple of questions for you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Coase. So in terms of how this works, you have 270 electoral college votes pooled together, sort of. And now, does that mean that the 51% winner within the national popular vote states gets all 270 votes, or are the 270 votes proportioned between the winner and the loser? As in, if someone gets 51% of the popular vote within National Popular Vote Compact states, do they get 51% of the electoral votes attached to those states, or do they get 100% of the electoral votes? Is it a winner-take-all system with the electoral votes within the compact states?
Representative Garrett and Representative Hicks, actually neither.
Okay.
First of all, there's nothing special about the popular votes cast in the 25 or so states that would be in this compact by the time we reach 270. The votes from all 50 states will be added together equally on an equal footing. And there's nothing done proportionately. 100% of the electoral votes of the states that adhere to the compact, which will be at least 270, are guaranteed to go to the presidential candidate who gets the most popular votes in all 50 states. So the way we guarantee the White House to the winner of the most popular votes in all 50 states is we have this group of, say, 25 or whatever states that have adhered to the compact. They have enough electoral votes themselves to elect the president, and they cast those electoral votes for the candidate who got the most popular votes in all 50 states. So there's nothing proportional. There's nothing special about the compacting states versus the non-compacting states. Every vote in the United States would be added together.
Does that mean that, theoretically, the candidate who actually lost the popular vote within the compact states could still win the presidential election?
Oh, sure. It's the candidate who gets the most popular votes in all 50 states will be guaranteed the White House. And there is nothing special about the compacting states at that point. Every vote in the United States would be equal.
One more. So, and in terms of which states are currently relevant in the system as it is now, it's, I suspect, not got as much to do with how many votes they've got. I mean, it's something to do with that, but it's really whether they're there's a possibility of them voting for one side or the other. I mean, and so, and I have a hunch. I mean, Oregon gets left off the list because we're a pretty predictable state, and I don't think that's national popular vote. I'm not seeing that changing. I'm not seeing that fixing the situation. I think we're still going to get left off the list because we're still going to be a pretty predictable state.
Representative Garrett and Hicks. Every vote is equally important. There is nothing special. Let's compare Iowa, which has slightly fewer electoral votes than Oregon, but almost the same number, okay? Iowa got 27 of the 253 campaign visits because it was a closely divided battleground state. That's why it got the attention. You didn't get the attention because you're roughly a 45-55 state, and no amount of campaigning in 3 months was going to let Romney win or cause Obama to lose, so neither candidate paid attention to you. However, under national popular vote, a vote in Oregon would be equal to a vote in Iowa. So no candidate is going to spend 27 of his 253 campaign visits, in other words, 10% of his visits in one single small state, he's going to spread it out so that Oklahoma and Connecticut and Oregon, both of which have equal populations, will get some attention. As a matter of fact, Oregon will get slightly more attention because, as you well know, because of your high civic participation culture and your mail voting, you actually cast more votes, more popular votes here than Iowa or Oklahoma or Connecticut.
Any further? Last call. It's 5 o'clock. Doesn't.
Can I give a one-line answer to one issue that was raised?
Sure, please do.
The issue was raised that there's nothing in this compact about adjudication. That's absolutely true. There's nothing in any interstate compact about adjudication. There's nothing in the bill that you are looking at that you heard before this about adjudication, because adjudication is covered by general laws involving how the judiciary works. So there is no flaw in this compact because it's silent on the method of adjudication. The courts and the Judiciary Act tell us how to do that. Thank you very much for
your time.
Thank
you. We appreciate you visiting us and bringing us this bill. Thanks very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3077, and without further business, we're adjourned.